You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We love at the Pagoda an event with a provocative title. And we've got Church, Do You Still Go? Which, you know, there's no wrong answer. But we're going to hear a lot of different thoughts about that. We've got an incredible panel. We've got Lamorna Ash, Jane Manfredi, Ginny McDonald, Andrew Rumsey, and John Philip Newell. And that this event is being chaired by Martin Rowe, who is a journalist, poet, and volunteer Anglican vicar. And he's going to be leading this session, and it will introduce you all to our amazing guests. So if you could put your hands together. Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Thank you, Lucy. So we'll have a conversation for 35, 40 minutes, and then we'll invite you to raise some questions, and our panelists will address those in the final third of our hour together. So let me first invite our panelists to introduce themselves, starting with Jane, and include a book club, a book plug, and any session they're involved in tomorrow.
Hi everyone, I'm Jane Manfredi. I'm a writer, I'm an Anglican deacon. I'm here also tomorrow morning at 11:30 in here, talking about my book, Waking the Women, which is about menopause and faith.
And I'm Ginny McDonald. I've been here all day. People are probably sick of seeing me. But I am a writer, broadcaster, author. My books are available in there. They're God Is Not a White Man and Unmaking Mary, Shattering the Myth of Perfect Motherhood. But I think on this panel tonight, I'm going to wear my main day job hat, which is as director of Theos, which is a religion and society think tank based in Westminster.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rumsey. I'm Bishop of Ramsbury, which is part of Wiltshire, and I'm the Church of England's lead for Built Heritage, and I have a kind of side hustle in music and writing as well, moonlighting career.
Hello, I'm John Philip Newell, and I'm living up in the Fintorn community in Scotland. I'm a wandering teacher in the Celtic tradition. In the Middle Ages, we were called Scotus Vagans, which is wandering Scots. And that's what I try to be, accountable to not church doctrine, but to the human soul, and try to speak truth from that place within us all.
Hello, I'm Lamorna. I've also, like Ginny, been here a lot over the last 2 days, so sorry if you're sick of me. This is my last session. I'm a writer. My most recent book just came out recently, Don't Forget We're Here Forever, which is looking at young people in Britain's relationship with the Christian faith.
Thank you, panellists. So, the first question, and I'll ask the panellists to go in reverse order this time, is as simple as this. Do you still go?
Well, I only started recently, so through writing this book, I went to sort of as many different denominational churches as possible, and shopping around for different churches. And I went to Quaker meetings for a while, and when I first went, I think I was too naive in my understanding of faith to really get much out of it, because I think I was looking for profound, large things to happen. And famously in Quaker meetings, things happen very quietly and slowly. And then I found St. Luke's West Holloway, which is the church where I met Martin, where Martin's an associate vicar, and was consistent for a while with that. Was still quite bad at making it, being awake on a Sunday morning. That's something I really struggle with. And now I seem to be moving between there and Quaker meetings, but a bit more inconsistently. I'm struggling with the habit. I'm struggling with having talked and written about Christianity a lot recently, and then finding it a bit overwhelming going into church. I'm not quite sure why that is just yet.
Thank you.
I don't often go to church. I'm not entirely opposed to going to church. I think I have a yearning for community, but I don't find myself in church very often. A couple of years ago, I relinquished my ordination as a minister of the Church of Scotland. I realized I could no longer hold together the the sort of theological doctrinal foundations of Western Christianity, which are so linked with empire in the 4th century when Christianity got into bed with empire. I found that what I was yearning for was much more expression of faith in relation to earth and in relation to paying attention to some of the deep wisdom of the human soul. Sometimes I'm in churches, sometimes churches, in fact, invite me to speak, which I'm always sort of honored to be able to try to utter in a church context. I think in my last book, The Great Search, I'm recognizing the fact that hundreds of thousands, and I suppose millions of my brothers and sisters from the Christian household are no longer within the four walls on a Sunday. And I think one of the important things to ask is, well, why are they not there? So the Great Search, my last book, is really looking at, well, what are we yearning for? So at this moment in my life, I'm really identifying much more with those who are in exile from our Christian household, although I still see myself as a very grateful son of my Christian faith. And upon relinquishing ordination, one of the things I became more aware of that I think I hadn't been very attentive to before is that deep in our Judeo-Christian inheritance, there's a tension between the temple on the one hand and the wilderness on the other hand. And I think that these two need one another. And that's sort of how I view myself now as being much more in the wilderness, but knowing that my family is within the four walls. So I'm in relationship with the church. I see it as my home, home that has given me so much. But trying to speak much more from the edge now.
Thank you, John Philip. Andrew.
Thank you. I'm obliged to go to church a lot, so I'm in church perhaps rather more than I would want to be, almost. But I think for like a lot of people who work within the church or church institutions, that creates sometimes a sense of challenge to know whether you would actually do so if you didn't have to go. And I've often asked myself that, and I found myself in this role being renewed by going into churches when there's nobody there. So I love church buildings. I mean, one of the things we might talk about as we go along is what, you know, we've got this one English word meaning both a body of people and a place built in stone. And I found myself going to churches much more than I ever wanted to do, but usually when there's nobody there. I would go if I didn't have to, but I'd probably be one of those people slipping in at evensong quietly into the back pew and not staying for coffee. Just a quick smile at the minister and out into the night. And I think I need to go to be retuned, really, sometimes completely restrung, actually, into the way of Christ. And I can't do that without the church, I think.
Thank you. Ginny.
So I am also a professional Christian. I'm not a church leader, but I write and think and talk a lot about the church, and I definitely critique the church with a big C across different denominations. I hang around the Church of England a lot. I speak at a lot of churches. But the church that I choose to be at on a Sunday, the place I guess that I don't have to be, but is my community that I belong to, I absolutely do go there, and I love it, and I love the people there. And is anyone from my church in the audience? Oh, hello. The reason why I love there are churches that I no longer go to, the churches that were very much formed me in my Christian faith, I no longer go to churches, conservative evangelical churches, although there are parts of them that I miss. The church that I go to now, I go to because it's a bit chaotic, it's a bit messy. It's about how we wrestle together with scripture, with our tradition, with each other, and in the entirety, in the whole of life. Our church isn't perfect, and that's why I still go, because it's messy. Mm.
Thank you. And Jane?
I suppose the short answer is, do I still go to church? No, I don't. But it's a longer answer that's a bit more complex, because I'm quite odd in many ways. So I became a Christian when I was 33 from like absolutely nothing. So from my whole family are atheists. They think that believing in God is like believing in fairies. They think it's crazy. And even though they love me and support me in that, they didn't really ever get it. I don't think they still do. So I became a Christian. I originally tried to join the Roman Catholic Church, but I couldn't become a full member because I'm divorced. So at the time, that was a real barrier. And that's how I became an Anglican. that was how I became an Anglican. And then eventually I was ordained. I'm a deacon. And then I had quite a bad experience, had quite a serious breakdown, and I no longer go to church. But it's an odd place to be. I completely identify with what John said about being in the wilderness. I feel like I'm spending time in the wilderness in many ways, actually. Part of my writing about menopause and faith is using that idea of wilderness as a metaphor, and how fruitful being in the wilderness can be. Jesus went into the wilderness and came out, and that was how he began his ministry. So I don't see that that's a barrier to faith. And I definitely still see myself as part of that body, even though I don't usually inhabit the building. But part of what I do is going into church buildings and still serving as a deacon. So yeah, it's an odd place to be, but that's where I am at the moment.
Thank you. So this panel is sparked by some research which was published recently, and findings that suggest there is, unnoticed in places, a quiet revival. That was the phrase that's used. Something is happening that we haven't noticed. There'll be a range of views in this room as to what that is, if it's anything. So let's ask first Chinny to respond to that, and then Lamorna, who's obviously spent an entire book researching this area.
Yeah, so the research is called The Quiet Revival. It's by Bible Society, who are my ultimate main employers. Theos is part of that. And what it shows is, it was some research conducted in 2024, which found that there is a significant increase in those who say they go to church, particularly among younger people, and particularly disproportionately among young men. The research found that the Church of England is not seeing the same increase as other denominations. And there's been a lot of kind of conversation about people not believing the kind of robustness or the methodology of the research, because the Church of England, it doesn't kind of tie in with some Church of England figures. It's not saying there's a rise in the Church of England. But other denominations, interestingly, are seeing increases, and they are Pentecostal churches, but also Catholic churches, Orthodox churches, so some kind of surprising denominations. And this was the second kind of tranche of research that's run by the same kind of group. So the same questions were asked in 2018 and then 2024. So for me, when I look at the research and the figures, to me, what have we been through in those past few years? We've been through a lot. A global pandemic, economic instability, cost of living crisis. I think that it's not surprising that people would be searching for something in this particular moment, because the world is on fire. And so to me, it's not surprising. And interestingly, there are other religions that are seeing similar increases as well in terms of attendance. And this is about church attendance. So whether or not people believe that people are actually coming to churches, and also just to reiterate, the title is The Quiet Revival. So no one is saying that people are being slain in the street and knocking down church doors to come. It's like very, very quiet. So the research says that lots of churches are seeing a few more people. That's what it's saying. And it all adds up to a larger number. So I think it's interesting. I think also in the conversations that I have in my day job, it is some data that backs up what feels like a vibe shift in our kind of cultural conversations about faith. So Theos, the organization I run, was started in 20 years ago, the height of the New Atheist movement. Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, those lovely guys, were all talking about how religion should have no place in public life. And that was what was in the atmosphere. It is completely different now. So if you think about the number of articles that there have been written by people about Christianity, or about kind of making tentative steps towards spirituality, or asking these questions in mainstream media, the podcasts, the films, it just feels like there's a vibe shift. So the data kind of, to me, backs that up.
Thank you. Lamorna.
Yeah, I think I find statistics like that so interesting, because then I suppose what it does is it freezes a moment. It's also incredibly hard to answer. You might all answer...
Oh, I think your mic's not...
Lamorna's mic working?
Is it working? Oh,
no. Can you borrow John Phillips?
Yeah, probably.
Maybe just...
Aha, yeah.
That one?
No, it's
one
green.
Okay. Here's another one.
Oh, God.
Here we go.
Thank you. Yeah, in terms of the questions that one asks and the answer you get with statistics, like the sort of simplicity of do you smoke, yes or no, even then there's complexity around, you know, how much do you smoke. But with asking someone when they go to church, it's so hard to know the granular stuff underneath that, or even the mysterious stuff underneath that, of whether they're going to stay, how long they're going to stay, for what reason they've gone. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I've loved about research over the last few years is having more of a sense of the long tides or the long shifts of Christianity in Britain, at least over the last couple, over the last 1,700 years, of that, you know, these moments when the world turns upside down, as in the Civil War, and you get these new arrivals and emergences of Christianity, and then it disappears again. And that Margaret Atwood line of, it's not that history repeats, it's that it rhymes, that we have these constant shifts. And when terrible things happen, when difficult moments happen, huge economic recessions, huge wars, pandemics, it causes this shift in people that's cultural. But humanity doesn't change, but where we go, our outlets shift. So I think I'm really interested in like how long this will last, how this will play out. And I think stats can obviously never uncover that. Time will tell, which is just interesting.
Okay. Andrew, you were mentioning earlier how data can become the story.
Yeah, I'm interested in the way that, as Chinny was saying about the vibe shift, about how actually people... responding to the idea of church attendance and their own reveals their own kind of affective or emotional or attitudinal perception of church life or attendance, even if the raw data in terms of regular attendance or habitual kind of belonging within the church might be harder to pin down, and that in itself is data. It becomes symptomatic, I think, of a change in the weather, really, and I think it could be reviving if it is quiet, and almost if Christians are quiet about it, which is hard when it's a great story, because I think there's a long history, as certainly as old as the British census, of real high levels of institutional self-consciousness, particularly in the church that I represent. And the British census began in the mid-19th century, largely at the behest of the Church of England, worried about how it was doing, and has to almost hypochondriac levels over this century and a half, whatever since, been checking its pulse. And a lot of the sociology of religion since the 60s has been quite obsessively concerned about who's coming in and who and how are we doing in a way that I feel doesn't always speak of a settled confidence in God. Let me put that, say that.
So know, if you had, you wouldn't really bother with those kind of surveys.
They are revealing, but the difficulty is that I think that when the church agonizes as we do, as the church agonizes in public or celebrates in public over much, it becomes unattractive. Whether we're doing it in terms of celebration or anxiety, and I just think that is off-putting and not. It creates a harder boundary than there needs to be of institutional belonging, which is, I mean, we might get into this, yeah. But how easy it is to get in on something that is so concerned about its own survival as a thing in itself. Typically, the church is meant to exist, as so many writers and people have said. Its perspective is meant to be on the whole, on society, on the world, to pour itself out for, rather than its own health as a thing separate from society, if that makes sense.
John Philip, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I can believe I'm not into the statistics of numbers either, but I can believe that there is an increase in church attendance. But I would also want to put it in terms of we are living through an enormous time of transition. And I think nearly every great discipline of thought is inviting us to be more attentive to Earth, to our relationship with Earth, and the essential interrelatedness of all things. And this Earth awareness is playing out in different ways. I think we're being far too slow to learn to come back into true relationship with Earth and one another. But I think that Earth consciousness is rising within us. And I think this represents maybe one of the greatest shifts that humanity has ever moved through. And in times of transition, the fundamentalist raises its head. Because the fundamentalist doesn't want to move forward with the new consciousness of the interrelatedness of all things. The fundamentalist wants to continue to think that, well, we'll look after our religion, or we'll look after our nation, or I will look after my family and not the family down the street, and so on. So that we saw another age of transition, an enormous age of transition in the 19th century in the wake of evolutionary thought, when Darwin and others enabled us to realize that everything isn't fixed and static. Everything is actually unfolding and becoming. And in the wake of evolutionary thought, we saw two extreme fundamentalist reactions from within Western Christianity. One was papal infallibility, was defined in a more hard-edged and extreme way than it had ever been before. So it was sort of make Christianity great again, or make the Pope great again. We saw something similar happening within the Protestant world. Biblical literalism came to birth in the wake of evolutionary thought, in a more hard-edged way than it had ever done before. So we don't like the way human consciousness is evolving and unfolding in terms of evolutionary worldview. So we want to make the Bible great again. And I think we are living through another transition age. We see political expressions of Make America Great Again. And I think we see religious manifestations of I will seek refuge in something of the past, and to the extent that the church got stuck in a hierarchical way of seeing and looking after ourselves and not the whole of humanity. I think we see it in sexual orientation as well. I think we see make heterosexuality great again. I mean, I think there are all sorts of reactions to this time of transition. So I can believe that an increase in church attendance might well just reflect an increase in fundamentalism.
Jane, what's the in your own local situation, do you see this signs of this kind of quiet revival?
I mean, I work with a lot of young people. So a lot of those are from refugee families. A lot of them come from Christian backgrounds. I think that, you know, local Roman Catholic Church has grown because of influx of immigration in the town. But I think this is also having a knock-on effect in the relationships that young people are making as well, because they're mixing more. You know, our town was, for a long time, was very, very monocultural, and that's far more multicultural than it was. And that has meant that, what was that phrase that you used before, Martin, about faith? What did you say about sharing faith? Faith begets faith or something?
Something to do with devotion, was it?
Yes. What was it, the quote that you said?
I don't know.
It was something.
I mean, they just fall out of me. I think you were sort of saying earlier that devotion begets devotion.
Yeah, so my I've noticed in my own children as well, and one of my sons, for example, has his best friend. One of his best friends is a Muslim, and he, you know, after struggling for so many years to get my children interested in faith and to get them to pray, and the thing that got him to pray was his Muslim friend who was praying during Ramadan, and this was something that was really curious to my son. His friend had a special allocated prayer space in the school, and he would go and pray. And that devotion was quite appealing. So I think that definitely in my local context, that's definitely something that's happening. I identify with what John was saying. I think that I've heard Christianity, the rise of Christianity, or the making it popular again. I think that there are that's quite some of the talk is quite dangerous. I think that especially when we're talking about cultural Christianity, and I see some very worrying things about the far right getting involved in that. And I think that Christianity is at its best when it is. When it is humble and it thinks less well of itself. So I think that's definitely... Lamorna, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I just think that, I suppose also to respond to John, that in times of turbulence, there is a rise in fundamentalism, but there is also a rise in resistance and activism and political rage. And I think that's the other side, that perhaps because it's even quieter sort of revival, but people looking for spaces where they see integrity and honourable politics, and not finding that in institutions, and being surprised by certain Christian spaces in which that's actually promoted, or the spaces like, I bring up the Quakers a lot, but I do think that my friend who's a young socialist, atheist Quaker, and sees no tension between any of those different ways of expressing himself. But he says that everywhere he goes on picket lines, he is looking for an equality that does not exist. And a Quaker meeting is run on the principle of equality. And so that's the one space in which he already sees that exists. And so I think that there is this sense as well of being like, what is this moment creating? And, you know, thinking like German Peasant Revolt, there are always moments in which Christianity can also be this rebellious resistance that goes back to a particular reading of the Gospels that has a kind of activist or a lens that's all about all men being, or all humans being equal. So there's room for that as well. It's not all doom, I think, in terms of the idea of revival.
Staying with your own research for a second, Lamorna, and young people in particular, we tend to think, we generalise that young people today are less interested in, let's say, partaking in formal religion than previous generations. What did you find in your research?
I found that there was a lot of curiosity and openness. I think maybe speaking to you as well, this young people grow up in societies that are far more diverse, meaning that young people in schools are much more likely to come across people of all different faiths. I think you were saying this earlier, then that makes you question, what is my own religious background and heritage? And if this person has managed to take from it and find their own way through it, why can't I do that as well? So I think because this sense of, like, I don't see this everywhere, and perhaps I've got this really overly hopeful lens, but this sense of increased tolerance of other forms of faith then retroactively goes back on you, and you think, well, what about me and my faith? It might be more complex. I think I've seen a lot of young people who attend, talking about this thing of wanting to go in at evensong and be quiet, but young people using churches as spaces as refuge, or other religious spaces as well, of saying, this is a place that... there is no kind of capitalism doesn't exist so much in these spaces. It's somewhere where I don't have to buy anything. I can sit and be serious. And I don't know, they might not tick anything on a kind of stats of whether they go to church, but certainly they're like, these spaces have value to deal with the difficulties and the vicissitudes of life today.
Thank you. Andrew, you mentioned earlier that it's complex for people to enter in. Sometimes there are barriers that we may be unaware of.
Yeah. I mean, the threshold of a church is an extraordinary. It's quite a powerful thing, really, in the way that it excludes, and I mean, just seeing the way that or includes, you know, how it admits or not, and the increased use of church buildings for things like live music venues is interesting, because as a lot of public venues close, churches are increasingly used for more public events and entertainment, and the complex responses that produces in people as to whether I can see myself in here, whether I should be in here, and what we should do within this space, I think is absolutely fascinating. And I do I see that a lot of renewed curiosity amongst younger people in built heritage and for deep places, that in some way, inarticulate or not, there is a presence greater than ourselves. And I think that's what a lot of people are seeking and finding in church buildings, religious buildings, is that presence greater than ourselves. Now, sometimes that's to do with the fact that there are often a lot of people who've died or are buried and memorialized around. But it's also the places that the churches constantly speak and tell a story of a divine presence.
So they're like
their own
containers of the numinous.
Yeah, completely.
We are dazzled, humans, by success, by, you know, the popular, by growth. In other cultures, you have things called mega churches. In your diocese, it seems to me you're more interested in micro churches.
Well, the church that is most frequently attended in Salisbury Diocese, apart from the cathedral, is only open four times a year, and it's on the middle of Salisbury Plain. It's in the village of Imbo, which was deserted during the Second World War, and people go there in their thousands, in busloads. Partly because it's inaccessible, it's really hard to get to, and I think that's hilarious, really, and very curious that there is. I'm not. It doesn't do it for everybody, but there is for a lot of people a sense of literally in that instance, lost community, lost belonging, lost belief. Can I access that? How can I reach that?
Yeah.
And I think. What I'm interested, I think, more almost than statistical research of the institutional kind is to know what season it is in church life, and anything living is going to be in a season of growth and death and life and so on. And a lot of the churches that I work in are in deep, either late autumn or deep winter. And so I've got used to being really patient. The buildings themselves are really patient. They have long memories and can kind of seen out plague, civil war, all kinds of things, times without ministers, all the rest of it. sheep walking in and out, roofs off. And yet there's a persistence there that I think is consoling and allows us to wait until the time is right again. Sorry, I'm going on.
There's a really fascinating...
I think I'd want to say that it's important that we not wait. Why are the churches sort of entering late autumn or winter? And I think it's because so often what's happening within the churches does not relate to earth. And I think part of the transition that we're going through is a desire, and I'm very interested in what you're emphasizing about the Quaker tradition, Lamorna, because I think that's a really beautiful expression of a very strong sense of the imminence of the divine, looking to expect to encounter the divine at the heart of every human being, and disciplines around paying attention to the divine within ourselves. And I think so much of our inherited form of Christianity in the Western world is based on a sense of the transcendence, the beyondness of the divine. And it's depended on a type of hierarchy of teaching, of dispensing truth from above, saying, you know, this is what you should believe. And that's from the 4th century Nicene Creed downwards. My friend Matthew Fox, who many of us know in relation to his important work, Original Blessing, in which he criticizes the extent to which we've been based on a sense of original sin, or what is deepest in us being opposed to the divine rather than being of the divine. Matthew was telling me that recently he wrote an article called The Whole in the Nicene Creed. And the whole in the Nicene Creed is that there's not one reference to the teachings of Jesus, especially loving our enemy, and especially loving one another as oneself. So, you know, we've based our faith, so much of our faith, on a hierarchy of belief about God, rather than nurturing a sense of encountering God, knowing God in and through one another and in relation to earth. And I think one of the reasons why people, why the church is in its late autumn or winter stage is because there's next to no reference to earth within the four walls in terms of the creed, the teachings, and so on. And I think we're yearning for a recovered sense of the divine in and through earth and at the heart of every human being.
Thank you. Chinny?
I was going to reference one of the... There's a really interesting book called The Afternoon of Christianity by Thomas Halich, the Catholic theologian. It's kind of similar ideas where he kind of asks the question of where are we? So I think it's Carl Jung who talks about a human life in kind of morning, afternoon and evening. And he says that we are currently, as the church worldwide, in the afternoon. We're in the kind of a different phase of life, and which means that we need to communicate differently, and we need to engage differently. We need to do things in new and interesting ways. And kind of connecting to this idea of earth, there are a number of other signifiers out there that suggest that point to this vibe shift. One of them, I think, is in sales of Bibles, which have massively increased in the past couple of years. And interestingly, the translations of the Bible that are most popular and seen the most increase are the more traditional, the traditional translations. So I think as much as we talk about kind of critique the hierarchies, I think sometimes people want that. Yeah. And sometimes people are searching for something that is other to them, something that is bigger, because for a lot of what people see around them is the failure of institutions, leaders, systems. So they're looking for something that goes beyond, and potentially they don't want to have to feel it in themselves. They want someone else to help them. Another thing that has seen an increase is in the number of people taking part in pilgrimages. Yeah. Massive increases in pilgrimages globally, including the Santiago de Compostela, but also pilgrimages here in UK. The fact that there have been, we're on season four of the pilgrimage on the BBC. People are interested in reconnecting with places and with history and with times and with places that require and ask something of you, that kind of ask you to go on a journey of some kind. And part of what's been really interesting in seeing those programs or people talking about those things is the reconnection with the place and the geography. And just also just thinking about young people aren't all one thing. Yeah. There are young people who are absolutely into kind of social justice, who want equality. What is also interesting is there are some other young people who actually want to hark back to a time before where certain groups of people had the power, had this, where Britain was a Christian country. So kind of one of the things that I'm concerned about, even though, yes, there is lots of good, is the intertwining or the alignment of cultural Christianity with empire and white superiority, Islamophobia, all of these things. So you're finding now Nigel Farage at Christian conferences talking about cultural Christianity and how we're a Christian nation, despite not himself being a believer, because they're kind of hooking onto something in our culture that people are aligning with Christianity for some reason.
I'm going to ask Jane to chip in, and then while Jane speaks, if you've got a question, please raise a hand over here or over here, and we've got some roving mics, I hope. Jane?
I find it funny, actually, because when I was exploring Christianity when I was in my early 30s, before I became a Christian, I really, really wanted to find an expression of faith that fit with my politics. So my politics were very left-wing, and it was very, very important to me that I found a church that fitted in with everything that I had always believed. And I'm not sure I ever actually achieved that. What I've seen with young people is that they want somewhere that will tell them what to think. I think a lot of them have been raised in a very, you know, a very liberal world where there haven't been any boundaries. And what I've seen with some of the young people I've worked with is that they are desperate for boundaries. They're desperate for some certainty in a world where they've told that they can be absolutely anything. Some of them are saying, I have no idea what I want to be or where I should be going or what to do. So they're coming to church, to Christianity, to offer them some of those answers. I'm not sure I have hope that the church in general terms can offer that, but I still do have hope for the church. Heaven knows why, but I do, because it's mainly about, for me, it's always been about relationship. That was what brought me to faith in the first place, was relationship. It was seeing people. A few people in particular, one person in particular, who has just the most, my best friend, who has just the most amazing expression of faith. And if you spend time with her, it is like being doused in Holy Spirit. And it was spending time with her originally that made me think, gosh, she's normal, but she believes in stuff that I've been taught is completely crazy. But she isn't, and that was incredibly appealing for me. I still have hope in that, and when I spend time with her, she is church for me. She is my church, and people like her. So
she is your quiet revival.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
Okay. Have we got any? Yes.
Can we have this mic on? Lovely. Yeah. What we're going to do with the Q&A is we've just got the one mic, so I'm going to head round and take questions from each section. Just a reminder, it's questions, not statements, and this is being recorded, so if you speak, your voice is going to be recorded, okay? Coming over here first. So help me get through. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Obstacle course. I have a question about the authoritarian dynamic in all of this and Karen Stenner's work at the turn of the millennium that predicted Brexit, Trump, all these things, and whether you think that there's something inevitable to people answering the question, would you rather your child was happy or did what you told them? That most parents say, I'd rather they did what I told them. But with things like, say, Montessori and these methods that cultivate Brian Eno today spoke about how can we discover what we like, what we want, and Nietzsche said a person can have what they want, but they can't want what they want. Yeah. So how do we want what we want, and the authoritarian dynamic in all this fundamentalist resurgence, is it inevitable to human nature to have to obey and want to obey, or is there a way of changing human nature?
Thank you. Anybody you'd like to take that on?
I think there is something that is within nature, a human nature, that does seek that out, and therefore those who have power have to be extremely careful about the way in which they respond to that. And speaking as somebody with power in an institution, that can be deeply damaging and can cause a lot of damage, the way we respond to that. So we have to do so very carefully and with great compassion and love, I would thought.
But I think that's so difficult to do because power by its nature does corrupt, and therefore that thing of the more power a person is given, the further they are levitating from the earth and unable to see how the rest of the world wants it ought to be behaving. And I think that's such a hard question in churches as well, as we know that abuse happens when people are given too much power. I don't think that's a fundamental part of human nature, but I think that by allowing people more power than others, that is where it ends up so often.
Thank you. Where's the person with the mic now?
Tent. Oh, there we go. Well, we're taking a question from outside of the tent just now.
Okay, let's have a quick one from outside the tent.
Outside the tent. Am I hearing anything more than this is nostalgia at a period where the world is burning and there's so much uncertainty?
Thank you. And let's have some women after that, please.
What was that? I didn't hear
it. Am I hearing anything more than nostalgia for the fact that, you know, the world is burning? It used to be much better.
Yes, you are. sorry to jump in, much more. I think the curiosity about faith is nostalgia, partly for the future rather than just for a lost past, and actually the longing to belong, the longing for belief, is something that seasonally rises up within people, and I don't see in this the curiosity that I'm encountering around the church just a desire to hark back. I find genuine spiritual hunger, which has always been there, bubbling up. So I think there is, you know, there's a significant amount of nostalgia mixed up in that as well, but it's not only that, I would say, and it's quite future orientated as well.
Anybody else want to chip in?
I think that the desire for community, the desire to belong in that sense is a deep human yearning. I think that part of what we're being invited into at this moment is to see our communion as being much greater than just with our religious tradition, much greater than just with our nation. It's a communion with Earth and with every human being, with the essence of every human being. I was thinking of that great teacher, Martin Buber, a great Jewish teacher who so honored the wisdom of Jesus. And one of the things he says about Jesus is that he received the wisdom of his own Hebrew tradition around loving your neighbor as yourself, and he pushed it beyond what his own religion had taught and said, love your enemy. And I think that this is part of what we are being invited into now, a sense of not just communion and community with those of our religion, but a deep sense of communion with Earth and with every life form and every human being. How do we take the wisdom of our Christian tradition and push it beyond any of the boundaries that have been placed on it?
Thank you. Another question? There we are. Yep.
I just wanted to ask for clarity. Is church worship services, or is it cafe, toddler group, keep fit classes, concerts, exhibitions, food bank, homeless shelters and pensioners, or is it just when we worship together?
Oh, right. Is that like a rhetorical question? Anybody want to comment on that?
Can I answer that one? The thing that brought me to faith was toddler group. it was toddler church, and honestly, if I was going to go back to church, I would go back to toddler church. not just because it's my level. That was church for me for a long time. That was my first experience of regular worship. It was I went when my, I've got four kids. I went when my two youngest were baby and toddler, and it was powerful. It sounds ludicrous, but it was. It was held in the actual center of the church by the altar, so it wasn't off in a church hall. We went off to the church hall afterwards for biscuits and juice and coloring and all the other things that you do at toddler group. But it was toddler church. The priest would light a candle. We would sit. There was a liturgy. You know, there was a recognizable liturgy. There was a routine to it. It was beautiful, and it was that made me through story, through song, through relationship, through lighting that candle and thinking about Jesus and who Jesus was. And didn't Jesus say that we should come to him like little children? So yeah, I would say it's so much more. It's all those things. Yes.
So that question begs another question to Andrew's point earlier. Sometimes we hear people saying people are attracted to cathedrals because they can come in and they can go out, and nobody says sign up on this rota here. Is there a critique of that kind of engagement, Chinny?
We at Theos are doing some research on cathedral attendance and what's happening in cathedrals, particularly post-COVID, following some research we did in 2013 called Spiritual Capital. And I think cathedrals have seen a significant increase in the past few years in attendance, including tourist numbers and people who go into the building and to go to various services. But one of the things that I think draws people to cathedrals is the transcendent, the numinous, but also the idea that you can go and you can leave. You can kind of just kind of sit at the back if you want. You can experience and kind of feel a sense of awe, and then you can leave. I think that is church. I also think that, yes, keep fit classes, food banks, toddler groups are forms of community that might engage people from the church or might be held in churches. And I think that there is something of God that we can see in those places. But I also think it is actually important to have gatherings of people who are wrestling with who God is, with tradition, with scripture, with being together. I think there is also a separate thing, which I think is attending church, which is also beautiful and not unimportant. So I wouldn't want to say that everything is church and everything is the same. I think there are lots of good things. I also think that church, going to church on a Sunday, is also good. And that's my practice.
Thank you. Anything else there, or should we go to another question? Okay, where's the mic now? Yeah, thank you.
Do the panel of self-confessed not church-going people have any advice for those like myself who are faith seekers and faith longers who are not finding it in a traditional church model?
I suppose it's really hard to answer that, but I think it sounds like if you're a faith seeker, you're already doing the right thing. That sense of keeping looking and being surprised by things and going to places with people you wouldn't expect to go to. I think the beauty of being a faith seeker is it suddenly allows you this opportunity to explore other religions as well, to make the most of the fact that to read holy texts and see where those take you. I suppose there's something about apportioning off time for those periods. Maybe it is Sunday and saying, this Sunday I'm going to go to this particular beautiful, or doing pilgrimage, going somewhere beautiful, and making the most of that and trying to make that feel sacred in ways that we do. I've got a friend who's doing loads of study into ritual at the moment and is off to go to Harvard Divinity School to think about maybe becoming rabbi, I'm not really sure yet, but did these ritual workshops with us where we would go to a particular place that had maybe some kind of spiritual or religious history to it. And then we would do all kinds of things to add rituals or sacred qualities to that experience together. So I feel there's so many different things that you can pick and choose from. There's so many rich religious histories to take from and then see that maybe something will stick. And if it doesn't, you can keep seeking forever.
Can I just add something there? I think that there is, so Grace Davey, the sociologist, talks a lot about belonging without believing and being in church spaces but not necessarily believing. And I also think that the line between the two is not actually that defined. Hands up if you go to church but you have doubted whether God exists sometimes. It's not that there are levels of my belief levels are changed day to day depending on what's happening or what I'm experiencing. And sometimes people really, really believe stuff and sometimes people don't. But that to me is part of the beauty of going to church. It's the keeping on attending and showing up and seeking. And there isn't this kind of, defined line between the two.
And just on a similar note, in the teaching of Jesus, an example of Jesus, I love the way in which he formed new kinds of belonging and community on the margins and outside, explicitly outside the religiously powerful groups. And he chides the Pharisees, of course. He says, you do not believe because you do not belong to my flock, which is just outrageous to them because they were the ultra belongers. And you know, I won't get on my parish hobby horse, but you know, the word parish is originally the community of those who don't belong. And actually the community of Jesus was deliberately formed around those who were unable to be, either it was put upon them or they themselves couldn't be part of the institution. And Jesus exactly goes straight to those places and said, this is now where community is. So there is there's hope there, I think, for each of us.
Final couple of comments from Jane or John Philip?
I was just thinking about that faith seeking and looking for the perfect church and to belong to, and obviously it doesn't exist. I think once you've realised that, or from bitter experience, that I think a lot of people have been hurt by the church, but still yearn to belong and still yearn to have a church community to belong to, or a place where faith might still be nurtured. So then you have to grapple with this uncomfortable truth, which is the church is imperfect, hugely so. So what do we do? what do we do with that? And I think one of the conclusions I've come to is that's how it's supposed to be. That's how it's always been. It's been a lot worse than it is than it is now. And that we somehow have to work out a way to still flourish with that, with all those people, with all those annoying people, including myself, we're all imperfect. And that's part of the beauty and the challenge of being church. I think Chini started off by saying that messy reality, which will annoy the hell out of you, but is also, I wouldn't change any part of my journey because that's brought me here. It's brought me to who I am, and God has been with me through all of that. And that's how we, I think that's how we learn and develop in our discipleship.
Thank you. Any final comments? Joy?
I think Jesus's invitation to seek in order to find it feels a really important wisdom from Jesus. And I think paying attention to our deepest yearnings is part of what's going to sort of lead us forward. And I think any religious system that, in a sense, has said all the ultimate answers have already been addressed, and this is let us give you the answers, is not true to the sacredness of desire. Simone Weil, the young Jewish woman who escaped Paris just before the Nazi occupation of her homeland, but then died tragically before the end of the war, she uses a phrase called the efficacy of desire. Mm. And this has been an important phrase for me to pay attention to, and I think what she's inviting us to look at is to pay attention to the deep yearnings of the human soul, and paying attention to those and asking how we nurture those deep yearnings is an important part of the way forward. She says it's efficacious to pay attention to the deepest yearnings of our being. And we do that together, not just on our own. And I think that's one of the great strengths of being in communion with others in a faith community, is that we pay attention to the deep yearnings in order to dream the way forward, in order to imagine the way forward.
Thank you. That's a good way to close. Please thank our panelists, and thank you all for coming along.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.